Well, we are in the last Sunday of Epiphany, which means that we have Lent coming up, and Ash Wednesday is this coming Wednesday. And so Lent, if you're not familiar with Lent, it's 40 days leading up to Easter, and it's a time where we set aside to deepen our focus on maturity and transformation. And the questions we ask are, you know, in this season, what parts of us are we hoping will continue to mature and transform? And so since this is the last Sunday before Lent, I thought this morning we could kind of set the table or prime the pump for the next 40 days. So why don't we do this? I want to begin a conversation on hope this morning. And we've talked about this definition that Brené Brown offers, that hope is not the absence of struggle, but it's a function of struggle. Right. So what she means is, if you come across something, you think, oh, I don't think I can make it. I don't think I can do it. And then you make it. Then the next time you come upon that very thing, you go, oh, I've done this before. I can do it. That's hope. Does that make sense? So why don't we do this? Share with a neighbor, is there something you've struggled through that now gives you hope? Maybe something physical, maybe it has to do with work, maybe a relationship. It can be more simple than that. It could be a video game you played. It could be like, you know, traffic. So turn to a neighbor, something you've struggled through that now gives you hope, all right? I'll give you a couple minutes. Go. All right. So something you've struggled through that now gives you hope. Would anyone care to share? Doing taxes, very good. Anybody else? Family, yeah. Okay. We've got taxes, we got family. Anybody else? Conflict, yeah. So I was thinking through this. Do you guys have stress dreams? Yeah. Did you guys have stress dreams in high school? Yeah, so it'd be a version of you'd show up to class, you didn't know a big project was due, and it's due. Or you didn't know it was an exam, you hadn't studied. You guys have those? Who had those kind of stress dreams? Okay. How many of you just transferred those stress dreams to your current work? Okay. So I have Vox stress dreams. So this is how the dream usually goes. Usually, like, it's an important Sunday, someone's visiting, and I care about their opinion, okay? Then often, I'll show up, and no one's there, or, like, hardly anyone's there. And then in this dream, often, either I'm speaking and I can't talk, or I didn't know I was supposed to be offered the homily, and then they go, and now Gideon sang, right? So it's, like, some version of that. So two Sundays ago, we've got to collectively live my nightmare. So if you were here two Sundays ago. So I've gotten to know the Episcopal bishop here in Austin. He's in Texas. And he was visiting that particular Sunday. I was like, cool, very honored that you'd come be with our liturgy. I woke up that morning with a fever. And I was like, oh, I really shouldn't go. But the bishop's going to be there. I'll just drug myself up. And then show up late, leave early, I won't contaminate anyone, okay? So that was the plan. So I'm already like fuzzy, full of drugs. So I show up at 10:35, our liturgy is supposed to start at 10:30. I walk in through the doors, and there's probably 10 people in the room. I knew the Austin Marathon was happening, but still, I was like, the bishop's here, there's 10 people here, cool. So I go upstairs, I don't want to shake anyone's hand, so I'm sitting upstairs in that window looking down. And then there's all this commotion in that breaker box. So people are like waving around that breaker box. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Then that front door opens and a 20-foot ladder comes like marching in. At this point, this is 10:30, 10:40. So I'm sitting up there. I was like, interesting. I look down. The Episcopal bishop's just sitting kind of in that back corner. And I'm like, there's nothing I can do. I'm just sitting there. It is what it is. Let it be so. That went on for 25 minutes. So our liturgy doesn't start until almost 11. I was like, it's fine. It is what it is. Kind of feels like my nightmare. And then I had one responsibility that day. I was supposed to introduce last week's speaker, Dominique. So I go, my friend Dominique's coming. He wrote a book called Rethinking Incarceration. I was sick at a few, I could not say incarceration. So I'm here on stage, I'm like rethinking in, and I was like, this is my actual nightmare. I'm actually reliving my nightmare. So I have a picture. I have a picture of what our projector now looks like. That's what it looks like now. It just stopped working right as liturgy started. And then that morning, Kelly Kupfer spoke. And she was so calm, grace under pressure. And everything was fine. So I've told this story several times. And then people are like, that's your worst case scenario. And you survived. You did it. And I was like, I did do it. I have some hope now, right? So Parker Palmer says the same thing that Brené Brown does, but with different words. He says this. Hope is the place where joy meets the struggle. So when you're in the struggle, you don't think you can. In that moment you're about to, there's joy. It's like, that's hope. Paul says this. Now these three remain. Faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. I actually think it's really beautiful and profound. Maybe this is what he's saying. Faith begins when we give up our addiction to certainty. So many of us grew up with what we were told faith, but it was just certainty. And at some point, certainty runs out or the bottom falls out, and then faith begins. But it's hard. It's a struggle. So hope forms then as we encounter God in our struggle with uncertainty. So it's really scary, actually, when you're there. But in that moment, you find out, oh, I'm not alone in this uncertainty. God is here. Then you start to form hope. And then maybe love then grows as we struggle over time in this relationship between faith and hope. Isn't that beautiful? And Paul says now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. Barbara Kinsolver says it like this. The very least you can do in your life is figure out what you hope for. And the most you can do is live inside that hope. Not admire it from a distance, but live right in it. Under its roof. And so the question I want to ask this morning is this. As we come upon Lent, as we prepare, what are your hopes for Lent? Like, what are your hopes for? Is there something in your life you're hoping to change? Is there a part of you that you're hoping, man, I hope it keeps maturing and transforming? What do we hope for as we enter these next 40 days? And so this morning, we're going to be in our lectionary text, 2 Corinthians chapter 3. As is our custom, we'll have it on the screen. Read it aloud to a neighbor, and then we'll walk through it, all right? 2 Corinthians 3. Go. All right, let's pick this up in verse 12. It says, since then we have such a hope, we act with great boldness. So this hope gives us boldness. It says, but not like Moses. I'm like, oh, Moses. Who put a veil over his face to keep his people. So there's a veil that separated him from people, from each other, from gazing at the end of the glory that was being set aside. So this is the backstory. Moses ascends a mountain to meet with God, and his face starts shining because he's talking to God. Or maybe it's Maybelline, we're not sure. And then when he comes down, he covers his face. He covers his face because people are afraid of God's radiance. And he has shame around the idea that his light might be fading. Isn't that interesting? And then Paul says this, but their minds were hardened. And then he contrasts it to the law and the spirit. If you can just bookmark that, we'll come back to that in a second. But when they hear the reading of the old covenant, that same veil is still there. So that's a version of the veil. Since only in Christ is it set aside. Indeed, to this very day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their mind. So he's talking about the law, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But I want to first focus on verse 16. It says this, but when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. So I wonder this morning if the veil is what we create out of shame of our shadows, of our darkness, and our fear that because of our shadows, we lose light. And so we create these veils that separate us from each other, that separate us from our souls, that separate us from God. If you're looking for a book to read over Lent, I highly recommend this one. Parker Palmer has a book called Our Hidden Wholeness. And he's talking about this very thing. This is what he says. He says, afraid that our inner light will be extinguished or our inner darkness exposed, we hide our true identities from each other. In this process, we are separated from our own souls. We end up living divided lives, so far removed from the truth we hold within that we cannot know the integrity that comes from being what you are. And he says this is important for several reasons, for us not to be disconnected, for us to discover our hidden wholeness. He says it's important because our inner light, if we don't discover it, our inner light cannot illuminate the work we do in the world. It becomes a product. It's not something that comes from the light of our being. He says it's important because our inner darkness cannot be penetrated by the light that is in the world. And it is important because people close to us then become weary of the gap between our onstage performance, the ways that we're acting out all these characters, and our backstage reality. And so the question to ask maybe in this season of Lent, do we hope to discover our hidden wholeness? Are we willing to enter this struggle, this lifelong struggle of reconnecting the disconnected parts of us? I was watching this clip, and strangely, Jim Carrey, I know, of all people, Jim Carrey, kind of talks about this very thing. And I actually realized I kind of like Jim Carrey. He's been in two of my favorite movies of all time, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind and Dumb and Dumber. Both excellent, lots of range. And this is what he says. Check out the clip.
They're all characters that I've played, including Jim Carrey, including Joel Barish, including any of those things. They're all characters. You know, Jim Carrey was a less intentional character,
right?
Because I thought I was just building something that people would like, but it was a character, you know? So it's, you know, I played the guy that was free from concern so that people who watched me would be free from concern, mm-hmm. you know? And then at a certain point you go like, okay, well, that's great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like the one thing, like people talk about depression all the time. The difference between depression and sadness is just, you know, from happenstance, whatever happened or didn't happen for you, or, you know, grief or whatever it is. And depression is your body saying, "F you, I don't want to be this character anymore. I don't want to hold up this avatar that you've created in the world. It's too much for me."
Right.
You know? And you should think of the word of depressed as deep rest. Deep rest. Your body needs to be depressed. Mm. It needs deep rest from the character that you've been trying to play. You know? The great and powerful Oz. I'm the great and powerful Oz. How dare you come near me? You know, kind of thing. And you're just the sweaty guy behind the curtain going, it's an amazing metaphor, you know, in that movie.
And I was watching this clip, and it reminded me of when Jesus in Matthew 7, he talks about us not judging. And he says, we see the speck in other people's eye, but we have this plank that keeps us blind to ourselves. And then out of these blind spots, we judge others. And then he calls people who do that, he calls them hypocrites, which just means actors. He says, we're acting, and then we're having these acting competitions. And then at the end of the chapter, he talks about building a solid house on a solid foundation. He's like, you don't want to build a house on sand, you want to build a house on a rock. And I wonder if what he's saying is our life built on a character is like building our house on sand, that at some point the bottom will fall out. And so maybe this is the journey of Lent, that we come to the end of the story, and so slight spoiler alert, Jesus dies. And as he dies, something in the temple is torn. What is it? It's the veil. And the temple is supposed to represent us, our bodies. And perhaps the journey of Lent is a reminder that death and resurrection is the process by which these veils are torn. And we rediscover who we actually are, our hidden wholeness. And so maybe a spiritual practice here could be this. If you want to, maybe just list the different characters you've played in your life. And then maybe just have some curiosity about the origin story of these characters. You can even write out the story if you want. And maybe in this season of Lent, maybe this year in 2019, which of these characters do you feel like has run its course and maybe you're just ready to let go of this character? All right, let's keep going here. So Paul keeps writing and then he says, now the Lord is spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is. He's saying when we get to that place and we can actually begin to get a glimpse of an unveiled life, we don't have to play these characters anymore. He's like, that's freedom. So let's try this as a thought experiment. When was the last time you remembered being free to be yourself? So who are you with? Maybe you were with people who knew you, kind of knew all your flaws, but still liked you. And then what did that feel like? When you're able to speak from who you are, able to not speak and just be present. Can you remember that time? What does that feel like? And what Paul's saying is that feeling, that space, that's the Spirit of God. I think sometimes we have this nebulous kind of over-spiritualized where the Spirit of God is. It's like when we're free to be ourselves and we're in touch with our soul, not disconnect from God, each other, that's the Spirit of God. And then what Paul does, so Paul and Jesus, they're often trying to convert religious people. They're always trying to evangelize to fundamentalists. And this is what Paul is doing here. So he talks about the law and how the law is supposed to be a structure that gives freedom. So we're going to get a bit nerdy here, if you can just hang on for a second. Okay. So if you think of like the law and the old covenant from the perspective of child development, okay? So earlier in the chapter, I think I have a chart here, he contrasts the law and the spirit, and he uses really strong language. So he says the law, and then there's the spirit. And he says the law is the letter that kills. So I think what he's saying is the law is like the basement. Does that make sense? It's like the bottom, like, rules that just keep us alive. And then he contrasts that with the spirit that gives life. So if that's the basement, then the spirit is the ceiling. Does that make sense? Then he uses other words for the law. He says it's the ministry of death. It's things like do not murder. It's like the basement things to keep us alive. If you're teaching a child, it'd be like, don't touch the electric socket. Don't touch the stove. It's the ministry of death. Like, don't die. Does that make sense? Okay. He's contrasting that then to the ministry of death, to the ministry of spirit. So maybe now when you understand don't touch the electric socket, you've got a handle on that boundary. Electricity is really useful. You can have electronics, you can have your phone, you can charge things. Once you learn to not touch the stove, the ministry of the Spirit is now learn how to cook. Does that make sense? Then he's saying it's also the ministry of condemnation. So when you start out with restrictions with children, it's always almost always negative. You're giving them some healthy structure and boundaries, okay? But then the goal of that, he says, is the ministry of justification. Now that you understand the boundaries, you don't have to prove anything to anyone. You already are. Now learn how to live. Does that make sense? Okay. So Anthony DeMello says like this. Love and freedom and happiness, they're not things that you can just cultivate and produce. You cannot even know what they are. He's saying you need contrast. To know what freedom is, you have to know what the restrictions and the boundaries are. He says, all you can do is observe their opposites, and through your observation, cause these opposites to die. Okay. I know this is a bit theoretical. Let me give you an example. So several weeks ago, we were having dinner, my family, with Harmon and Jen's family. We were eating at Via 313 and E6. You guys have been there? Okay. So it was like a nice Austin winter night. It was like 75 degrees. We ate outside, and it was so nice, we decided to walk down the street to Gemelli's. So in our minds, it was like 3 blocks. It's probably like 12 blocks. But so we're walking, and then I think Jen and Karen were talking in the back. Joshua was sick that night, so he was kind of quiet standing next to me. Noah had rented a Lime scooter, so he's just like zipping up and down 6th Street with his hair flowing in the back. Harmon was pushing Lincoln in a stroller. And then Phyllis next to me, and Phyllis 5, she starts chatting me up and we're talking. And then at one point as we're walking, she takes my hand. And I was like, oh, we're having this conversation. I've seen her grow up. And we're going to walk to have gelato holding hands. It gave me such great joy. So I had like 10 seconds of joy and we're walking down the street. Phyllis holding my hand. And the joy of her taking my hand was contrasted by the violence to which she shook off my hand. So she held my hand for 10 seconds. 10 seconds later, she just shook off my hand. And I was kind of confused. And I was like, oh, we just crossed the driveway. She needed to hold my hand across the driveway. So I asked Herman and Jen. I was like, how did you teach her to cross the street? Their first instruction was, don't cross the street. You're too short. Cars can't see you. Don't cross the street. Next instructions. When you cross the street, Mom and I have to hold you or hold my hand. I have a couple of pictures of Phyllis. So I think Harmon took this picture of her, and she didn't want to stand in the middle of the street because he wasn't holding her hand. She understood the rules, right? And then she's crossing the train tracks with her mama here. Okay. So it dawned on me. I was like, oh, she took the negative restriction. Don't cross the street. But she's learning discernment and wisdom and learning how to cross the street. In that moment, she didn't even have to run to ask her mom and dad. There was just a tall person next to her. She was like, I will take this tall hand. I will let go of the tall hand. Driveway crossed, right? And I wonder how many of us who grow up in fundamentalist structures or religious, we were told not to cross the street and we've never crossed to the other side. We were told never to touch the stove and we've never learned how to cook. We were told not to eat things off the ground. We've never actually tasted real food. Does that make sense? And Paul's saying these structures, these boundaries are meant to actually free us, to give us life. So you take, for example, maybe the Sabbath, okay? So some of us, maybe we follow, practice the Sabbath literally, and that's okay. That's probably a great place to start. So every how many days you're supposed to rest? 7, right? So on the 7th day, just stop doing things. It's negative, right? Don't do anything. But maybe as we start practicing that literally, you're supposed to learn discernment. Oh, what does it feel like to be tired? What's the difference between emotional tiredness, physical tiredness, spiritual tiredness? What do I need to recover those parts of me? What are the things that I do then that actually give me life, help me recover? Does that make sense? And then maybe it eventually frees us to be people that are healthy and rested and present. But the religious establishment of the day, of course, was like, no, this is only a restriction will always be a restriction. So they start setting these restriction traps. They're like, all right, let's bring a sick person to Jesus on the Sabbath, see what he does, right? We're going to get him. And then Jesus, of course, as expected, heals this person. And he says, what's the goal of this restriction? Is it to do good or evil? It's supposed to free us to do good. Is it supposed to help us heal or not heal? It's supposed to free us to heal. And so maybe a spiritual practice here could be this. So some of us fast over Lent. It's totally optional. But if you choose to fast from something over 40 days, you're not bartering with God. Some of us think fasting is like, okay, I'm going to stop drinking coffee. And so I need a promotion. God, I haven't drank. Like some of us think like that. Or some of us think, well, I kind of did this thing I regret. So if I give up something, it'll be like even because God's got his naughtier. Like that's not what fasting's about. So what if we fast? Fasting is a self-selected restriction. It's just something we want to restrict. It's a temporary boundary. And when we select that temporary boundary, just try to connect the dot. Meditate on its path to freedom. So I'll give you an example. Let's take coffee. I'm a coffee drinker. I love coffee. But let's say we decide to fast from coffee for 40 days. So what would be the connection there? Maybe we can ask, oh, okay, what level of my life am I living where each morning I need to jump? Okay. Like, what is that beforehand that require makes me need coffee? It's a good question. Excuse me. And then maybe in the morning, why do I need this jump? Like, is work my only purpose in life? And so does it, like, take me out of myself so I just work harder and harder and do more and more and more? And so as we're creating this temporary boundary, you're asking questions of ways to live and become more free. Does that make sense? And Paul says, now, the Lord is spirit. Where the spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And then he says this, all of us, imagine all of us. Imagine this world, all with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of God. So I don't know, growing up, this phrase, glory of God, was often repeated. And it would always frustrate me. Like, because people would just say it a lot, like, glory of God, glory of God. It was kind of like people saying, hook 'em horns, hook 'em, glory of God. It's like, are we on the same team? Glory of God. Like, are you on my tribe? And then I would always ask, like, what does that mean? And all the answers, I didn't even have theological framework to, I just knew it didn't really make sense. Because all the answers, it seemed like God was this, like, egotistical, needy, like, do you remember Finding Nemo, the birds? Do you remember the birds? Like, mine, mine, mine. Do you remember that? And this was the explanation of the glory of God. Like, my glory, my glory, my glory, my credit, my people, my world, right? And then somehow we just need to say, glory of God, glory of God. And it would appease his small ego. And I just was like, that can't be the glory of God. So let's try a thought experiment. Think of someone you know that for the most part, not always, feels pretty connected to their soul. Like they feel pretty free to live as they are. They're not trying to be liked. They're pretty grounded. They're in self. They're connected to God and each other. Can you think of a person? Is there someone in your life that maybe you've encountered that? Okay. So picture that person's face. Picture the energy of that person when you're with them. You know what Paul's saying? He's saying when you encounter that, that's the glory of God. God's glory is so generous. It's so giving to the other. And he's saying when we can be connected to our souls, connected to God, ourselves, when we experience that, that's the glory of God. And then we mirror it back to each other and you mirror it, mirror it, mirror it. And you kind of picture this like infinite mirroring of us as ourselves. Parker Palmer says it like this. I think I have the quote in the video skip. So we'll do the quote and then jump back. He says, wholeness, this is what I like. He says, we're not talking about perfection. He says, perfection isn't good news. Wholeness doesn't mean perfection. It means embracing brokenness as an integral part of life. Knowing this gives me hope that human wholeness, mine, yours, ours, need not be a utopian dream. If we can use devastation as a seedbed for new life. He says, we arrive in this world undivided, integral, whole. Just look at a baby. But sooner or later, we erect a wall, this veil, between our inner and outer lives, trying to protect what is within us or to deceive the people around us. Only when the pain of our dividedness becomes more than we can bear do most of us embark on an inner journey towards living divided no more. And I'll just close with this. This whole picture of like mirroring, this infinite mirroring, and the glory of God in each other. Some of you have been in the infinity rooms that Kusama created, the artist. Do you guys know Kusama? So she's a Japanese artist. There's a documentary on Hulu that you should watch right now. And it's fascinating for several reasons. So she was grew up in a traumatic family that didn't really see her as an artist and kind of rejected her. And then out of that rejection, she started making art. And then the art world in Japan didn't receive her, wouldn't accept her. And then George O'Keefe wrote her a letter and then got her to the U.S. And then she started a career and was in shows in the 60s in the east side of Manhattan with Donald Judd, with Andy Warhol. So all these people became big, but because she was a woman and she was Japanese, she wasn't seen. No one would pay attention to her. They would actually steal her ideas. So Andy Warhol, Donald Judd, in the 60s, boom, got big. And then it took Kusama 30 years. I was like, oh, that's a measurement of privilege right there. You know how much longer it takes a woman and a woman who's Japanese to be seen, her art to be appreciated? 30 years. And then what she did over 30 years, she just created beauty. She just made more and more and more and more beauty until that beauty eventually reflected back to her and the world, her own beauty. So check out some of these infinity rooms. For pumpkins. And so Vox, will we, as we enter onto these 40 days, consider to struggle for the hope of reconnecting the ways we've been disconnected and mirroring God's beauty and radiance until it mirrors and mirrors and mirrors infinitely. And so may we begin this struggle for hope, Vox, the hope that we can be born again to our lives that began connected to God, our souls, and each other. May we examine our veils and the characters we play. And when they are ready to fall into deep rest, to let go of the certainty that these characters offered us. May we experience the good news of the freedom of God, the glory of God that is so beautifully generous, that shows up when we see each other for who we fully are, darkness and light, sinner and saint, fully known and loved and liked. And I'll close with this poem called Hope by Victoria Safford. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not at the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, nor the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges, nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything's going to be all right, but a very different, sometimes very lonely place, the place of truth-telling, about your own soul, first of all, in its condition, the place of resistance and defiance, the piece of ground from which you see the world both as it is and as it could be and as it might be, as it will be, the place from which you glimpse not only struggle but joy in the struggle. And we stand there, beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing, asking people what they see. And we pray this in the faith of God, the hope of Christ, and the love of the Spirit. Amen.